and conventions. Government officials from poorer countries denounced the announcement, saying the IMF, as well as the World Bank and WTO, lack international accountability due to the fact they're not subject to international law. What about that issue of not being bound by international law, Jokey?
It's actually a huge contradiction, because the World Bank and the IMF, as they like to say, their shareholders are governments of the world, which have, you know, under the UN, have come up with the UN Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the Convention on the Child, the Rights of the Child, Convention to End Discrimination Against Women. So if the same governments are sitting in New York at the General Assembly, are also members of these institutions, the rules that they make in New York at the UN General Assembly should apply at all times and in all places for all projects. In fact, this is what we have maintained, that the World Bank and the IMF should recognize and respect, defend and protect internationally recognized human rights instruments and human rights positions. They are not exempt. Absolutely not exempt. And this is why when then they start talking about, you know, other things, how they care about the poor, how they care about growth and development, then they can't make that statement on one hand, say they don't care about human rights, and then expect us to take them at their word when they say that they care about development and they care about the poor. They should be bound, like every government, every institution should be bound by this international recognized human rights instruments. The World Bank and the IMF should be no exception.
I want to go to a kind of case study. Sylvia Federici, you have co-edited a book, A Thousand Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities. Your chapter, The Recolonization of African Education. Can you talk specifically about the student movements? You lived in Nigeria for years.
Yes.
And what is happening to the African university?
Basically, what happened in starting when 1984, was that as part of the package, structural adjustment, IMF package, which the World Bank and the IMF were basically imposing on Africa, most African countries, in the name of solving the debt crisis, which was supposed to be a package that was guaranteeing the recovery of African economy. None of that has happened. In fact, things are far, far worse than ever were before. But as part of that package, one of the conditionality was a major, major cut in social benefits, from healthcare to education. In the case of education, that meant that basically the government had to withdraw completely any public funding of secondary and tertiary education. The World Bank claimed that this was to boost, to shift funds towards elementary education, but actually did not materialize, and this was not the case. Rather, what was the case was that for in the mind of the World Bank, I think this is very important, you know, Africans were the destined to a particular type of work in the International Division of Labor, basically destined to do manual work, farming. In fact, at one point, a World Bank officer said that. He said, Africans don't need universities. You know, you just need some secondary training, some vocational training, and that's that. By the way, this was the policy of Leopoldo of Belgium, you know, in the Congo. So they basically cut... University have cut pretty much everything, funding to buildings, to keep maintenance buildings, to libraries, to get books, to cut students' allowances for food, for transport, again, for books. Remember that many students in the last decades have begun to come from a poor family. The African students, as privileged, you know, as they may be, we compare to the many who don't have access to education, many of them come from poor family who could never, they could never go to school, and particularly to a university, unless they had a subsidy. That has been cut. Teacher salary has been frozen. Basically, with the university teacher salary, now you support the family for a week. Particularly because in addition to the wage freeze, you also have massive, massive devaluation. So the African campuses have turned into battlefields. And this is where We have begun to do this work, recording the struggle, recording, criticizing, analyzing the significance of this World Bank plan for education.
How organized are the movements?
The movement is very well organized. In the book we have, of course you have to remember, first of all, that this movement now is at least 20 years old. And it's a movement that at first seems just to respond to the immediate situation. But when you begin to look at over a 20-year period, and when you begin to look at the nature of the demand, the perspective of the struggles, you begin to see that what African students are fighting now is a new independence struggle. That what we have in Africa now is a movement that has the same significance as the student movement had in the struggle for African independence. It's really a movement about self-determination. You destroy the educational system in a country, you destroy the future of the new generation, you destroy the future of the youth. Regardless of what was the content of that education, African students were in the process of battling, discussing, redefining the education they wanted to have. Comes the World Bank, that is over. The university itself is becoming a wasteland. And the students now, many of them have been forced out. They now come to the United States. They try to emigrate. In Brooklyn, if you go to a car wash, you will find many graduates from African universities. I understand that if you go to Greensboro, in the chicken poultry of North Carolina, you're going to find many graduate students or aspiring students from Niger and other countries.
I want to end with you, Jokey Jehu, on the issue of the globalization protests, because on the one hand, you have Sylvia Federici describing what's going on in Africa, this new independence movement led by African students. And on the other, you have the globalization protests from Genoa to the World Bank protests here as largely white, something very different, of course, than on the African campuses. You yourself are from Kenya. You're leading the protests here. Do you see it changing, and what do you think is the key for the integration of these movements?
Well, I think that one of the issues that keeps a lot of people of color out of these movements is the culture of the mobilizations and the collective that exists, because of the ways in which these collectives work, these coalitions work, not just people of color, but more experienced elders, if you will, of the movement activists are not able to participate in these movements. And there is a great deal of work that needs to be done by activists in countries like the United States to look at the ways in which they exclude, whether intentionally or unintentionally, the ways in which they exclude people of color, the ways in which they exclude elder activists, the ways in which they exclude people who are of low economic social status, poor people, and others, because it is as well as gay, lesbian, and transgendered people, because of the culture that exists. A lot of the coalitions are very cliquish. They have schedules where people meet in the evenings. The meetings are in the evenings. If you have a child and childcare concerns, if you have young children, it's not very possible for people to participate unless you bring your child with you, or you have other arrangements that you can make. But when you look at a number of organizations, if you look at 50 years is enough, just to give an example, of the five people working in our office, myself, a colleague who is a Haitian American, a work study student who is from Nigeria, and a high school student who is Korean American, that there are lots of people of color involved, but for whatever reason, they are not able to participate except on, you know, sort of on the outcasts or outskirts of these mobilizations. There's a lot of work to be done around anti-oppression, anti-sexism, anti-racism work to be done by those of us who are involved in mobilizing to make this a movement that is broad and diverse and that includes rather than excludes, which happens to be sort of the way in which most of these coalitions are functioning. And people, you know, citing pressures of limited time to organize and all of that, are quite resistant to dealing with these issues, I must say, as a self-criticism of the movement. And it's something that we have to deal with. Otherwise, it's really all lip service, and we are not much better than the institutions that we are targeting and saying that they don't listen to ordinary people and the people affected by their policies.
We only have 20 seconds, but Sylvia,
I think what Njoki is saying is very, very important. And I would like to add another dimension, which is it's very important that people realize that these days, these days of action, like what is going to happen around the World Bank or what happened in Genoa and so on, you know, they are not the places in which all is decided. But they are part of a long struggle. They come from afar. They come from places like Africa, from African villages and towns and so on. And therefore, the issues and that struggle have very deep roots. I think it's very important, both because the question of the power relations within the anti-globalization movement must also be talked about on an international level. And second of all, because there's too much of the tendency to put all the stakes into these particular days and not realize that all over the world people are struggling now against globalization.
On that note, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Contact information, Njoki Jehu, 50 Years is Enough, where can people go on the web?
www.50years50years.org or call our office at 202 IMF Bank, 202-463-2265.
And 1,000 Flowers, Social Struggles Against Structural Adjustment in African Universities, co-edited by Sylvia Federici, is published by Africa World Press in Trenton, New Jersey. I want to thank you both very much for being with us. There's also a booklet that has just been put out on the issue of that the Committee for Academic Freedom in Africa put out called State Violence and Structural Adjustment in African Universities. And if people want to get a hold of that, where can they call?
They can write, we have either to my address.
Give a phone number.
The phone number would be 718-622-2240.
I want to thank you all for being with us. When we come back, we're going to take a look at a conference that has been taking place in Geneva, just finished up, and what it has to do with the conference on racism and with the United States. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, and if you got to hear that little interlude of music, it's Warrior Trilogy, and that is Lightfoot from the CD Tribal Boogie, and we hope to be joined by this Native American rapper later in the week. Well, with all the controversy surrounding the upcoming UN Conference Against Racism in Durban, South Africa, another UN meeting on racism has gone virtually ignored in the United States. This morning in Geneva, the UN released its report on the U.S. compliance with the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Racial Discrimination. The committee noted with concern the incidents of police violence and brutality, including cases of deaths which affected minority groups and foreigners in particular. The group also said there was also a disturbing correlation between race and the imposition of the death penalty. Unlike many other international treaties, the U.S. actually signed and ratified this treaty. That means if the U.S. is found to be noncompliant, the U.N. can require the United States to change its laws. Leading human rights groups, civil rights, and constitutional rights groups from the U.S. recently traveled to Geneva to testify on the state of U.S. compliance with the convention. Nancy Cheng has just returned. She's with the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York and was in Geneva for the preparatory meetings around the convention. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
It's great to have you with us. Well, start off by explaining the significance of this meeting and how it relates to the Durban conference that a lot more people are focusing on.
Right. Well, Amy, this is this was a historic hearing at the United Nations in Geneva that was held on August 3rd and 6th. The Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Race Discrimination was actually adopted by the General Assembly of the UN in 1965. It took the United States until 1994, nearly 30 years later, to ratify it and enter it into force. And although the first U.S. report was due 1 year later, it took the U.S. 5 years to produce its first report. This was the first opportunity of the Committee on the Elimination of All Forms of Race Discrimination to review the U.S. report, present questions, and hear the United States out, and as of yesterday, issue recommendations.
And the findings.
Exactly.
But what they found in yesterday's report, talking about the correlation between racism and the death penalty, et cetera.
Exactly. We have the press release from the United Nations. We have not yet been able to get from our friends in Geneva a copy of the actual recommendations and report. But we see that the committee has focused on the legacy of race, state-sponsored racism in our country. We see that they acknowledge that because of our policies of slavery, acceptance of segregation, and policies toward Native Americans and the Chinese Exclusion Act and the Japanese internment camps and so forth, they understand that the United States has lingering effects of racism that permeate every aspect of American life. And one of the key problems that came up in the U.S. report was the refusal of the United States to agree to eliminate racism when it rears its head in the form of disparate impact, racially discriminatory results, which appear at least appear to have a race-neutral basis.
Like the death penalty?
Exactly. And this became one of the large, one of the major sources of criticism of the U.S. report.
We're also joined on the telephone by Tim Cooper, who is Executive Director of Democracy First and a representative of the World Organization Against Torture, USA. He coordinated the NGO effort in Geneva. Can you talk about the role of the NGOs in a covenant like this?
Oh, well, good morning, Amy. I'm happy to be on your show.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Yeah, this is a new venue for U.S. NGOs to, or new tool rather, for them to elevate the issues that are of most concern to them, particularly in the area of racial discrimination. Heretofore, U.S. NGOs have concentrated primarily on domestic lobbying and the creation of new law and so forth to affect domestic policy, but before the UN and specifically the Committee on the Elimination of Racial Discrimination were able to bring to bear the moral forces of international law to elevate our issues and to press the U.S. government to advance those issues in a significant and serious way. So we are now entering, I believe, a new era where the integration of international law into domestic law will serve our purposes, and I think in many respects, and with particular regard to this treaty, there are higher standards of international law than can be found at the domestic level. And I think that Nancy alluded to that when she talked about the issue of the effect of a policy rather than the intent of a policy. Under U.S. law, you have to prove intention to discriminate, whereas under international law, you just have to show that there is the effect of discrimination. That's I think, the essential difference between the race convention and U.S. Jurisprudence at this point.
And what relation does this convention have to the upcoming Durban conference? Does it have any effect on it?
No, it really doesn't. It is coincidental that the hearings were held at a time when preparations were being made for Durban. And I think it was timely and helped elevate the NGO community's consciousness about using this convention as a domestic tool to advance policies against racial discrimination. But essentially they're separate and apart. And the committee will continue to meet twice a year. U.S. NGOs will be back before the committee in a number of years. And this will go on, whereas the event in Durban will be a one-time event.
Nancy Chang, you do a lot of specific work in the United States through the Center for Constitutional Rights, dealing with violations of rights. Again, people might be listening to this program saying, they're talking about all these large UN treaties. I mean, what real effect do these have on our lives and the kind of work that you do as a grassroots activist and lawyer?
Well, that was the frustrating part about this event. We have a constitutional system where our key provisions, the Equal Protection Clause, which requires equality in matters of race, and the Fourth Amendment, have failed to put an end to race discrimination. In the case of the Equal Protection Clause, 25 years ago, the Supreme Court held that proof of intent to discriminate is required. Disparate impact is not enough. In the case of the Fourth Amendment, our Supreme Court has held that the Fourth Amendment allows vast discretion to law enforcement in making decisions on whether to stop, frisk, search, question, arrest individuals. And as a result of this discretion, racism and race discrimination is allowed to permeate our criminal justice system. We see it in the end product, where we have 2 million people in prison, of whom 46% are African Americans, in a population where only 12% is African American. We see it at the stop and frisk stage, at the very outset of contact with the criminal justice system, where surveys on highways show that overwhelming numbers of individuals stopped and frisked are Black and Latino. And of course, this is directly attributable to our war on drugs and our training that our federal government has provided to our state and local authorities under Operation Pipeline.
Tim Cooper, something like 32 out of the 38 countries that have gone through this review process have been ordered to change their laws as a result. Now, what does that mean? I mean, in the United States, there's a huge conservative backlash against, you know, and also not just conservative. I mean, the protests against the World Trade Organization included a lot of people who said we can't have these supranational organizations, you know, larger than countries, determining our laws. And here you have that very thing.
Well, I think you have to separate out WTO. That's a very different issue than a committee that has jurisdiction under an international treaty that the U.S. government has in fact signed on to and ratified through constitutional processes, and that treaty then becomes incorporated into U.S. law. That's a distinction that's important to make. As to backlash, look, this question was raised at a press conference in Geneva. Are we bashing the United States government? And I think my response was simply this, that we are simply asking the U.S. government to live up to its international legal obligations that it solemnly swore that it would undertake to carry out. And we are simply asking the U.S. government to live up to the letter of this convention. And I'm not at all certain as to why that should create any kind of backlash whatsoever. It's simply a matter of law, and we're simply here to say the U.S. is obligated to uphold these international standards.
So where do you go from here, Nancy Chang, as you come back to the United States? Are you going to go to the Durban conference?
I'm not able to go, but I think that we need to... We see from the press release that the committee was very critical of the U.S. in a number of respects, and we need to follow up on this. They specifically mentioned that our criminal justice system is definitely definitely has a race-based character to it. They've commented on the death penalty and sought a moratorium. We have to pick up from where the recommendations they've left off and push in the United States for a true elimination of all forms of race discrimination.
Final words, Tim Cooper.
I think it's especially important is that the U.S. government must ensure application of these standards at all levels of government, not only at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. And this was the way that the U.S. government framed its argument by saying, well, we really can't affect what goes on at the state or local level. We can only kind of focus in on the federal concerns. But the committee is saying, no, under international standards, you need to ensure application at all levels of government. And that's a very important statement on the part of the committee.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. Nancy Chang, if people want to get in touch with you at the Center for Constitutional Rights, where can they call?
Area code 212-614-6420.
And Tim Cooper, if people want to get involved in these activities, what would you say is the next one or what people can hook into right now as Executive Director of Democracy First and Representative of the World Organization Against Torture, USA?
Well, the World Organization Against Torture does a great deal on U.S. compliance with various international agreements, including the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. So that'll be one of our next projects. We can be reached at 202-783-8046.
I want to thank you both for being with us. And before we outro the whole program, we thought we'd end where we began, and that is with Michael Franti. We started with Rock the Nation, and now we go back to our roots, and that is listener-supported.
Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Ha ha. Don't take no prisoners if you can't afford to feed none. Don't start no fights if you cannot predict the outcome. Don't make donations where you cannot get your dough back. The hypotheticals, send them all your Prozac. I will not climb into your telephone tree, and hell no, you cannot put me on hold. It's the same recorded message you've been singing all along. Keep handing us the Bible while you're walking off with all the gold. The bureaucratic office sends you merry-go-rounding, but the KKK police the streets by bloodhounding. Interest on the credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can...
Michael Franti and Listener Supported. And speaking of Listener Supported, we want to thank the brain trust of our producers, Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson, Anthony Sloan, our engineer and music maestro, Errol Maitland, our spiritual technical director. And I've been instructed to acknowledge those who make Democracy Now! Possible. Corporation for Public Broadcasting supports Pacifica Radio. And we'd like to thank the Pacifica stations, KPFA, KPFK, KPFT, WPFW, and WBAI, as well as the Pacifica affiliates. We are all Pacifica. We'd also like to thank John Alpert and the folks at DCTV, that's Downtown Community Television in New York, who've generously allowed us to broadcast from the historic firehouse on the edge of Chinatown. And special thanks to Chase and Andy. Yes, reporting from the studios in exile from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fired, the studios of our listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
Never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
Please join us in celebrating Project Underground's fifth year of success in building community power. There will be food, a raffle, and music by Aaron Gale's daughter, Henri Pierre, and DJ Jeremiah. We start at 6 p.m. on Friday, August 17th, at our offices on the corner of Berkeley Way and MLK Jr. Way. Call 510-705-8981 or visit www.moles.org. A $20 donation benefits Project Underground's ongoing work with communities resisting mining and oil exploitation. The event is wheelchair